like I say, he was there alone with after the victim was deceased for several hours. I mean, we're talking a long time. Just laid him in bed with him. And we also found written in blood, "Please send to heaven, Todd and Matt."
Warning. The podcast you're about to listen to may contain graphic descriptions of violent assaults, murder, and adult language. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Murder Police Podcast, The Murder of Todd Shoemaker, Part 2.
Well, first of all, any idea how long they'd been a couple?
About half a year, according to relatives and Mr. Donahue himself.
Any legal history of domestic violence? Any
no, no.
I was always curious about that.
There was an interesting issue about this case. The couple shared a dog. It was primarily Mr. Schumacher's named Monroe. And there was an argument. This was a couple of weeks before the murder. Mr. Donahue had gotten angry at Mr. Schumacher, taken his dog and put it in the oven and turned the oven on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So he killed the dog.
No, they got the dog out in time. But then the animal control got involved and oddly enough worked with us on the homicide. I'd never worked with animal control in a murder investigation.
Cool.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty cool people.
They know their stuff.
Yeah, so did Matthew stab the dog and the same time as he was stabbing Todd? Was the dog unharmed?
We never found Monroe.
Oh, wow.
So.
Do you remember who you work with animal control?
No. She was fairly new, and I was super impressed because we had a suppression hearing in this case, like we always do. I forget what evidence they tried to suppress, but she showed up at the suppression hearing, and I was like, hey, what are you doing? And she's like, I just want to learn because I may have to go through one of these one time. And it's rare that people will take time out of their current job and assignment to go watch something else in hopes of learning something to maybe advance their career. So it was I was very impressed with her.
I'm trying to think of how to pronounce her first name. And I feel awful about this because she's probably listening. Jai or Jay. And
yes.
Jay, yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel awful about that because I've actually been in communication with her on the case.
Oh, really?
A little bit. And what I might do is I think she's agreed to do it, is to come in and do an epilogue on it, on animal abuse and how that translates.
Absolutely, it
does.
Because
she is really sharp. I worked with her a little bit when there were some conversations when I was on the command staff about warrant service and things like that when we were trying to coordinate. And you're right, she's a detective.
Yeah, she is. I remember she gave me a call on down the road after that just asking for advice, and very impressed with her because, heck, half the time we try to get young detectives to come watch testimony and like, I'm busy, I can't make it. But for her to, certainly not obligated in any way, it was just her own self-motivation to learn things and become better at her job.
Yeah, hopefully we get her on here.
That would be great.
It would be a great epilogue to this to kind of fold into that because there are relationships between people who do very evil things to animals and what they might do to people. So, I think she'd be the ideal person from animal control to come and speak to it.
So
Monroe was never found. Did you ever ask Matthew about Monroe?
Yeah, he made a comment about it. The dog must have gotten out at some point. But like I say, he was there alone after the victim was deceased for several hours. I mean, we're talking a long time. Just laid him in bed with him. And we also found written in blood, "Please send to heaven, Todd and Matt."
Oh, Lord. Where was that written at?
In the bedroom wall.
Wow.
Yeah. So, Mr. Donahue has had some real issues. As Dave and I were talking before the podcast started, that he had a juvenile record that was sealed that I couldn't get into. And when they're sealed like that at such a young age, typically it's something really bad. And I wound up, of course, this made the news, as most homicides in Lexington do, ran into a school teacher that asked if I was the one handling that case. And I said, yes, I was. I was like, well, what's your interest? She's like, well, I was a teacher of Matthew Donahue. And she's like, yeah, I had to give statements about something that he did that I'm still not allowed to talk about. And she said that as a young child or student, this is elementary school, she was scared of him.
Wow.
So he had some severe mental issues.
He had mental issues, but to keep it straight a little bit, he was evaluated, because we'll get to trial in a minute, but I just want to make sure we're clear on the idea that that was sorted out in court before it actually stood trial, obviously.
Yeah, and Dave, we dealt with people with mental issues, and you can be a full-blown paranoid schizophrenic. Those are pretty easy to spot, but it's the sociopaths, the borderline personality disorders that you start to pick up on if you've dealt with them enough. And just an amateur guess, I'd say he has borderline personality disorder, very manipulative, very intelligent. He played the victim role very, very well. And luckily we had the evidence at the scene, because again, it's like you can do this for 50 years and get a read on somebody and be wrong.
Right.
That's why we need evidence to convict people. Exactly. You know, I don't ever want to go on my gut. And I don't like not believing individuals I'm interviewing, because I've been wrong before and I'll be wrong again. But it's so nice to have that evidence tucked away from the scene that you know that you can, you know, poke holes in their story with. But no, he was very convincing, played the victim role very, very well, but I just knew he was lying.
Wow. So you get your confession from him, and
admission. Yeah.
Admission from him. And
well, in the interim too, after that, you talked about the autopsy. Did you attend the autopsy?
I did not. We were still doing stuff with the investigation. It's typically the next day. So forensic service detectives go up, and that's when they told me the count was over 100. So I was floored at that. And he had them all over his body from the top of his head to his feet.
Did they have any information, and this goes back a ways, so if you don't remember, that's okay. Do they have any information about depth, or did the knife hilt make contact? You know what I'm talking about? Is it a lot of times they're serrated?
It was we believe the murder weapon was just a regular kitchen steak knife, probably like 5 inches long, and several of the stab wounds, especially to the abdomen, were very, very deep.
Was the murder weapon at the scene?
It was.
Okay, cool.
And also, you know, I was wondering, with that many, you know, how long did Todd endure this before he passed?
There's no way of knowing.
Because
hopefully the first one was,
you would have to
got an artery and he bled out quickly, because if not, you know, that's a horrible, horrible way to go. It's a
torturous way to it's something to endure. That's awful.
Well, and again, I do believe, just because of the size difference between the two, he attacked him while he was laying on the couch or sleeping. So that's where he got in probably several devastating wounds. And then the rest was all just rage.
Coming back to the interview, did he ever move off that last point of self-defense and a couple hits? Did he ever hint away to anything like that?
No. It wound up when we were starting to confront him about the multiple stab wounds. Like, well, where did this happen and why? Why was the back of his calf stabbed? He, again, it's like, I'm just so exhausted. I probably do need an attorney at this point. So he lawyered up for the second time. Okay. And at that point, he didn't want to talk anymore. So we respected his constitutional rights and shut the interview down, filled out the paperwork for murder, and sent him down to the Fayette County Detention Center.
Now, before you sent him, did you all, like, seize his clothing or anything? Is that a practice?
Yeah, we did that. And during the interview, you can hear he's complaining because we have bags over his hands that are taped. So he can't wash off any blood or anything like that. So we took precautions with that. Once he got to the hospital, his hands were bagged by FSU. And we had a jumpsuit for him, got him in a jumpsuit and took all his clothes for forensic examination.
Gotcha.
Did he ever say why he dragged Todd all the way back to the bedroom?
He loved him, just wanted to be with him. So is a moment where he just snapped for whatever reason, and we'll never know. But then reality sets in after his 5-minute version of a struggle, and he probably realized that I can't lie my way out of this. So he went back there, laid with him, and probably did some thinking about how can I concoct a story around this, and the best he could come up with, you know, two unknown intruders. There was no way he could clean that house, get rid of the body, and say, no, Todd, he just left to go get cigarettes and I never saw him again.
Yeah, because the couch cushion flip was kind of a modest attempt as it is, kind of not real bright. And probably that too is that the idea of laying with him for that long too. Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking the schematics of it with the size difference. How did he drag him that far and get him up in the bed?
Yeah. I mean,
that's 6-7 inches difference in height.
Mm-hmm. Well, dragging him wouldn't have been too hard, but getting him on the bed probably would have been a struggle because, horrible to say, but dead weight is difficult to move around. But yeah, it's and that's where I think he probably did a half-hearted attempt to take his own life. He saw there's no way he was getting out of this. But then I think he was surprised by the family showing up and had to go with that story about two intruders.
That he concocted,
Yeah.
So he had handed that story to the family, I guess.
Yeah, to the family and then to the initial officers at the scene.
So the autopsy gets completed. You get that new information. Probably wasn't a surprise because of the amount of damage there and whatnot. Neat that you recovered the knife at the scene.
I would imagine he was just overwhelmed with trying to figure out a way out of this.
Well, and I'm sure the knife was probably the least of his thinking. Where is he going to put it or hide it? I mean, unless he's going to vacate the residence to take it somewhere. I mean, there's only so many places you can hide that knife.
Yeah, they don't think that through too good. I've only seen one time we had a murder off of Willard Street, I think, one time, and then they actually called a guy, and he reminded me of Wolf in Pulp Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
He was a cleanup artist.
Oh.
And he had cleaned the apartment. It was a stabbing so well that the first run through FSU really didn't detect anything until they got a statement, and then went start pulling the toenail rails out and stuff like
that.
But I remember Craig Sorrell interviewed him. And it was like talking to Wolf in Pulp Fiction. Mm-hmm. And he's like, he goes, first thing I told him, get all the silverware. And they're like, why do I have to throw all the silverware? And he goes, because there's one piece missing. You got to get all the silverware. And it's funny, but not funny. But that's a real life thing, too. So anytime you do that, you have to be willing to take those extra steps, I guess.
Yeah. Now, I remember, I think it was the Alex Johnson case where he was in the garage. That's where they put him in the barrel to transport him down to the river, and we did some swabs to see if we could find any blood, and there was such a small amount on the railing of the garage door. And I think Marcy Adkins at the lab, who you all have had on before, who's fantastic at
her
job,
amazing.
She solved a lot of murders for me that I take credit for.
Sure, yeah.
As all cops do. Yeah.
Sure, she would love hearing that.
No,
and she will.
Yeah.
She will, Marcy.
Marcy in the lab has been so good to me over the course of my career. So many people. Matthew Clements, who's in ballistics, you know, I could call them at any time. And if it was legit enough reason, they'd jump me as close to the front of the line as they could.
That's that relationship that you get with people, and it makes it.
Yeah.
She's going to be back, and Bill Breslin will be back, and we're going to try to get him through one where he doesn't cry or weep. And but Bill and Marcy have agreed to do one, and I'm not going to disclose what it's about, but it's a serial offender.
Yeah, very scary guy.
Yeah, very spooky, and she is brilliant.
Yes.
She has the ability to, I think for our audience especially, she can take that into layman's terms so quickly and make people understand.
Well, Marcy she's one of those where she could have easily transferred from the lab. She could have been a homicide detective and a very good
absolutely.
One.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Her linear and analytical thinking is right on.
Yeah, she would have been fantastic at that job.
She's patting her own back right now, and she should be.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely, exactly. She should.
Yeah, exactly. So we get through the autopsy, we recover the knife and everything, and he's done making no statements after that.
Correct.
And that gets tricky. A lot of people don't know. Maybe we'll do an educational show on Fourth Amendment, and then it moves into First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, all that kind of, it's kind of convoluted as to how it gets more difficult to interview somebody the longer they're in that first couple of weeks. I guess what we're talking about now is what kind of things went on in the aftermath after he goes to jail. Walk us through what the investigation looks like and the things that you're doing to tie this up.
Well, this one is actually really short and simple. Those domestics typically are. You're not having to run down alternative suspects or anything like that. Like I mentioned before, we swabbed the heck out of the house. Turns out, once he admitted that it was just he and Todd, and he was the one that stabbed him, all that blood and swabbed kind of became useless because we know the blood belongs to the victim, Todd. And if there's fingerprints on things belonging to Matthew Donaghy, then that doesn't tell us anything. He lived there.
Useless until you get on the stand.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But, and then when you get cross-examined as to why you didn't do it.
Yes.
So you still, it's perfunctory to some degree, yeah. But you still do it.
And you're always, I had a murder case where we only collected 15 items and I only sent off two or three items to be tested because it was a domestic as well. And I got grilled on the stand for cross-examination. I didn't send enough off to the lab. I already had my mind made up, stuff like that. And it doesn't matter. If I sent off 99 things to the lab, they'd say, why didn't you send off 100? You know, it's just a tactic that they use, and I understand they've got a job to do.
Sure,
but
absolutely.
Yeah, as long as you can articulate why you sent something off or why you didn't, you're fine.
Right. It's funny, too, how we're talking about a quick case because it's so isolated. And we were just listening to the Culpable podcast the other night, Wendy, on season two, where they're talking about the murder of Brittany Stikes in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And really good investigators, you can tell. It's an unsolved case, but I think they'll get there. But one of them was talking about the challenge on a whodunit when what people think are tips or conjecture in theory, once that lands, because they're talking in that case about thousands of tips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The guy that allegedly killed the four kids in Idaho, I think. When they talk about having thousands of tips, I don't think some people understand that that's 1,000 things.
That's 1,000 interviews.
That's it, at least.
Right? Yeah.
And every one of them has to have a bow around them.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal that I always try to get across to people is a tip is something that might move, but geez, oh, Pete, don't ever confuse that for a theory you have.
Yeah.
I mean, don't paint that in a different way.
Well, I'm sure you had some cases. I've had several. Where you get to a point in the investigation where you kind of hit the end of the road and it's like, should we take this public, you know, put it on the news because you need their help, but you only want the viable tips. Because once it goes out there, you'll get 100, 200 leads and you have to follow up on every single one.
Yeah, they've all got to be wrapped up.
Yeah, because if you don't, that one, if you have 200 tips and you only do 199, by the time it gets to trial, those defense attorneys will be convinced that that one person you didn't do was the real killer, and we've wrongly arrested their client.
Mm-hmm. That's even if it's an unequivocal case.
Yes.
I mean, it'd be neat for people to experience that, to be on the stand when it happens. But even if it's an unequivocal, I did it, and the evidence is there, that's their job.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've got great ones in town.
I've
already done our defense attorneys more than once, and I'll continue.
Yeah.
They're amazing people. But neat stuff. So in that case, yeah, it wraps up pretty quick then, too. So
yeah, the investigation part is actually – in this one, it's probably done in 4 to 5 days, and that's all the paperwork and everything, sending stuff off to the lab.
So you get to kick your feet up on the desk because, like, obviously there's nothing else going on in town, right?
Absolutely.
That's it. Like, what, maybe 2-3 years, you'll have it. I'm being facetious. Yes.
Of course you are.
Exactly.
That is a and, you know, there's the gallows humor up in homicide.
Sure.
You have to have it. But it's a good feeling when, you're next up and you finally get one. And it's like, okay, this isn't a whodunit. I can solve it, wrap it up pretty quickly, and then I go to the back of the line, you know. And that's maybe you get lucky and your number's not called again for 3 months, 4 months. So, you know, you're not busting your butt on this unsolved murder, because those are the worst when you get an unsolved and you're still killing yourself, and then you get another one.
Which is the nature.
It's
like, that's it. That's where all that loose ends. I think my land speed record for one was a derby day where a guy got beat to get death with a 2x4 off 3rd Street. And I think I was able to be back home in about 4 hours.
Yeah, those are nice.
Yeah, exactly. I had some stuff to do afterwards, but I had somebody in custody. I had statements. I had the physical evidence recovered, and we got to it. But yeah, that never happened again. And you're right. That's the raking leaves on a windy day.
Yep.
They're always coming in.
It's a really good analogy because it just doesn't stop. You just hope for a breather from time to time.
And I think if somebody gets into the business, I think it's a mistake they might make. Don't ever think you're going to be done and kind of it's the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
But when you do leave, to this day, and I've been gone a long time, I still will be out doing something and I'll think about one of them that didn't lay down. You're just always like, if I could get back and do this, that never leaves you.
I'm pretty lucky in that. I think I've only had 2 unsolved in my career. And I work them to exhaustion.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, so I'm at peace with that. But I still get, I've been gone over a little over a year now, and there's still some PTSD. Like, when I hear a certain phone, a ring type, that was my ring when I was in homicide at 3 a.m. I'd hear the ring. And if I hear that exact ring, it's like, it takes me back and I'm not happy about it.
Sure, exactly. But I will say this, I kind of miss it enough to where, like, when we're talking about David Kelm's family or the Hasty family, which is South, beautiful people that have an adult son we covered, Michael Gorley, that went missing and hasn't been seen, and there's foul play all over that. There's also a part that makes you want to go work them.
Oh, you never, it never goes away.
And that's an inside thing that you're thinking, boy, or like if I'm listening to a good podcast myself, again, I'm going to pitch Culpable because it's really good. The entire time I'm thinking, boy, I would probably think about this, or this would be an avenue. So it's fun to think about, but you don't have to go in and do it, and you're not getting paid for it. So
I think Travis Holt, who's a really good detective, I think he's running Cold Case now.
Right.
Very sharp guy. I'm sure he'll do great at it. But I've seen other departments have former homicide detectives come on as consultants.
Right.
And if Florence Weathers is out there listening, you know, I'd be certainly happy to come back and review some cases because it is fun being part of it. I just wouldn't be the main one responsible. I'd just give some ideas and maybe some guidance and see where it goes.
Yeah. I won't name any names, but I did get hit up by somebody several months ago. And God, I love him to death. And he's not there anymore, but he had an idea of having an event. Where a lot of us going back as far back as we could get together, spend an entire day and just talk about what's on that shelf.
Yeah.
And I was like, brilliant. Well, that won't happen. No, right. It's like, but it was a neat concept.
Well, when they asked me to take over the cold case unit, I had the idea that, because I think at the time we had 50 maybe unsolved murders going back to the 70s or 80s. What I wanted to do was take 6 weeks, not do a damn thing, but read every case file and put them in categories. It's like, okay, these are potentially DNA cases.
Right.
Okay, we'll set these aside. And when I get to them, I'll go through all the evidence and send a ton of stuff off to the lab. These are pounding the pavement cases. Like, we need to reinterview some people, maybe some new ones that they missed. They go over here. And then there's some that, no fault of any detectives, sometimes the bad guy wins. They get the breaks.
Sure.
And there's just hardly any solvability to those, and set those aside so you can work on the ones that actually have a chance of getting solved. And the first thing you do is you send all those off to the lab, and hopefully you get a phone call or two in 6 months. And it's like, hey, no, this belongs to so-and-so, you know, and those, the low-hanging fruit, as they say.
Sure.
You know, it's like, give me those any day of the week. I don't need to beat my chest and say how great of an investigator I am. It's like, no, you give me a DNA hit and I'll go put the cuffs on.
That, and look at what it does for the family.
Absolutely.
I mean, whether it's low hanging fruit or high hanging fruit, I think that the name of the game is to see how many of those you can get.
Yeah. I just finished up a couple, pled guilty to a cold case murder that happened in 2010. But yeah, that's when I made contact with the victim's daughter. I knocked on her door and told her who I was, and she was like, don't get me involved unless you believe you can solve this, because I'd already come to a certain amount of peace with it.
Right.
I don't want to live through it again if nothing's going to happen. And that's tough, because I was like, I can't promise you anything.
Mm-hmm.
All I can promise you is I'm going to give it my all, and I'll keep you in the loop every step of the way. And I was fairly confident I knew who did it. And, you know, we had some avenues to go to get some information, and luckily we were able to make it happen. But yeah, she was scared that I was opening up the case again, actually.
Everybody metabolizes that in a different way, and I could see that. I could see where that's...
Yeah, she's like, don't make me go through it again if nothing's going to happen.
Right.
So that was a real relief off my shoulders when we finally got the arrest of the two individuals. And yeah, she was very grateful and also frustrated that it took 13 years, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Crazy. Well, let's go back to this one.
Sure.
That didn't take 13. It, thank God for the family on that, is... where do we go now? Pretty quick investigation, get some things back, some lab work. You got your autopsy reports and everything. What happens next?
Hey, you know there's more to the story, so go download the next episode like the true crime fan that you are.
The Murder Police Podcast is hosted by Wendy and David Lyons and was created to honor the lives of crime victims so their names are never forgotten. It is produced, recorded, and edited by David Lyons. The Murder Police Podcast can be found on your favorite Apple or Android podcast platform, as well as at murderpolicepodcast.com, where you will find show notes, transcripts, information about our presenters, and a link to the official Murder Police Podcast merch store, where you can purchase a huge variety of Murder Police Podcast swag. We are also on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, which is closed caption for those that are hearing impaired. Just search for the Murder Police Podcast and you will find us. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe for more and give us 5 stars and a written review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts. Make sure you set your player to automatically download new episodes so you get the new ones as soon as they drop. And please tell your friends. Lock it down, Judy.